Section 4, Life in the Backcountry. As you read, look for the significance of the Great Wagon Road, different groups of immigrants who came to North Carolina, farming methods in the backcountry, how settlers in the backcountry passed on their culture, and the following terms: backcountry, prairie, girdling, gristmill, and toll. Until 1730, almost every resident of North Carolina, aside from the Native Americans, lived east of the fall line. Only a few settlers had even ventured onto the coastal plain. After 1730, however, settlers filled in the coastal plain and moved west of the fall line. By the 1750s, backcountry towns like Cross Creek, later to be named Fayetteville, on the Cape Fear and Halifax on the Roanoke were being created to serve as market and government centers. Hillsborough, Salisbury, and Charlotte were founded primarily to serve as county seats. Newcomers to the backcountry. Most of the newcomers traveled from the northern colonies, particularly Pennsylvania. The lower cost of land in North Carolina drew them south. The name backcountry was new to the colony at the time. The word referred to the land that was back of the settled country, the land near the coast. Many newcomers followed an Iroquois warpath down the Great Valley along the Shenandoah River in Virginia. This 731-mile trail was gradually widened and became known as the Great Wagon Road. Benjamin Franklin estimated that 1,000 wagons a month went down the Great Wagon Road after the full harvest. Travelers knew that they had left Virginia and entered North Carolina when they could see the craggy top of Pilot Mountain. History by the Highway, Trading Path. The trading path was the first path that actually crossed through North Carolina. It likely dated to Native American trails that predated Columbus. But it was widened and straightened in the 1670s when Virginians came to trade with the Catawba and Cherokee tribes. Later, white settlers pushing into the backcountry used it. There are 15 historical markers tracing the route of the trading path. This one is in Salisbury. Section 4, continued. The Scots-Irish. The first people to settle the backcountry were the Scots-Irish. They were descendants of people from Scotland who had been transplanted to Northern Ireland during the 1600s as part of an English plan to conquer the Irish Catholics. Within a generation or two, the lands of Ulster, Northern Ireland, became too crowded. When the English began to tell them how to worship, many Scots looked for new land and religious freedom in Pennsylvania, which accepted people of all types. Then Pennsylvania grew too crowded. Because unwelcoming Iroquois lived to the north, the Scots-Irish headed south and scattered themselves from one end of the backcountry to the other. A few took up farms in today's Orange County. Most settled between the Yadkin and Catawba Rivers, concentrating in the area today bounded by Salisbury, Statesville, and Charlotte. The Germans. Coming right after the Scots-Irish were the Germans from Pennsylvania. These people had first come to Philadelphia in 1690 to escape conflicts in their homeland. They filled up the hills to the north and west of this city of brotherly love in less than 50 years. Then great numbers of them headed south for new homes on the western edge of North Carolina. The largest Dutch settlement was in what is today eastern Rowan and Cabarrus counties. John Lippard, who had first come to Philadelphia on a ship from Rotterdam in 1739, left Pennsylvania with his father's and his own household in 1754. Their new home was on a branch of Dutch Buffalo Creek in what became Cabarrus County. English Quakers. Mixed into the backcountry by the 1760s were people who were English in their background. Many were Quakers, part of the religious movement started in England in the 1600s. Because the Society of Friends rebelled against some English customs, many took refuge in Pennsylvania. Some came to North Carolina. African slaves. Quite a few of the early Scots-Irish households brought along one or two slaves with them. Twins Paul and Saul, owned by Adam Sherrill, became the first backcountry settlers to cross the Catawba River in 1747. Only a few Germans owned slaves, and Quakers had already begun to question the idea of humans as property within their faith. The Moravians. The most distinctive people to come to the North Carolina backcountry were the Moravians, a close-knit German-speaking community who first arrived in 1752. The group originally came from Moravia, which today is part of the Czech Republic in Europe. They continued to live in tightly organized villages where they worked and worshipped with one another. Their official name, the United Brethren, described their approach to living. They practiced brotherhood, and sisterhood for that matter, every day, all day. Like most other immigrants who sought religious freedom, the Moravians came first to Pennsylvania. When land became scarce, they petitioned Governor Dobbs for permission to send some of their members to the backcountry. Dobbs, delighted that such an industrious people would move there, quickly got Lord Granville to give them a land grant of 100,000 acres. The area came to be called Wachovia, which means little meadow in German. They constructed their first village, Bethabara, in 1753, and a second village, Bethania, the next year. In 1766, the Moravians had established their principal town, Salem. Today, Moravian culture of the 1700s can be seen during a visit to Old Salem, a historic site featuring several original buildings or recreations within the city of Winston-Salem. The Highland Scots. The last of many ethnic groups to come to the backcountry were the Highland Scots, who wedged themselves into the Sandhills. Most were victims of a rebellion against the British in 1745. To punish the Scots, the British laid waste to much of the Highlands, reducing thousands to poverty. Then British real estate agents tricked thousands into coming to North Carolina in the 1770s, promising fine land. The immigrants found that the sandy slopes were not what they had been promised. Most stayed, however, for going home was not a better option. Native Americans. Finally, a few remnants of Native American groups could still be found in the backcountry of the 1760s. North of Wachovia lived the Saura, part of the Siouan people who had once controlled the region. Near the South Carolina line lived the Catawba, the largest Native group left in the backcountry. By the 1750s, the Catawba had only about 100 warriors, one-tenth their previous strength. Periodically present, however, were the numerous Cherokee, who resented any intrusion into their mountain hunting grounds. Most whites did not venture that far. Carving out farms on the frontier. The earliest settlers to the Carolina backcountry found exactly what they wanted, land. The area near the Great Wagon Road had long stretches of prairie, meaning that there was more open grassland than there were woods. The prairies had been managed by the Native Americans, who burned off the grasses each hunting season. The woods in the bottomlands near the streams had trees as wide across as the Conestoga wagons that had brought the settlers down the road. All a backcountry farmer had to do was first burn off the grass, then cut into the roots and soil with a plow and a hoe. The settlers cut down enough trees for houses and fences, then practiced girdling on the rest. Girdling consisted of stripping the bark for about 2 or 3 feet around the tree. Over time, the severing of the sap lines dried out the wood. When the dried trunks fell over, they were easily chopped for firewood. Because of these practices, the area had dark black soil, not the red clay that so many later North Carolinians would know. These open spaces provided the earliest settlers with two ways to make a living: grazing cattle and growing grain. Cattle were allowed to roam free. Each family registered a mark, a notch on the ear, that identified an animal as theirs. Each fall, the younger sons of families gathered up the cattle and took surplus cows to the seaports and sold them for slaughter. Some families did the same with hogs, which lived off acorns and grubs in the woods. Growing grain was as important as raising livestock. The Germans in particular planted wheat and rye in the fall, let it grow slowly over the winter, and reaped it in the spring. Farmers like Hermann Husband stored the kernels in barrels, then took them to be ground into flour as they needed them for bread. One of the first ways any settler could become wealthy in the backcountry was to build a grist mill, a place to grind grain into flour. A miller took a toll, a payment of a portion of the grain, each time the mill was operated. The smart miller then sold his collected flour locally or loaded it on wagons and shipped it to the coast. Everyone planted corn, which fed both person and beast. It could be planted among the girdled trees in the bottomlands and left to grow on its own and dry on the stalk. In winter, it was put in a crib and shucked and shelled as needed. If properly stored, it could last for years. The home front. Most settlers quickly worked to improve their places. The smart ones put up zigzag split rail fences around their grain fields to keep out unwanted animals. Almost all the families built double pen barns. These log storage sheds had pens or stalls separated by a passageway. The structure was roofed over with wooden shingles. Most backcountry families lived in log houses that resembled the size and shape of their barns. A few families came south with enough money to build large homes for themselves. Michael Braun, a German, erected an immense stone house for his family in 1764 right off the Great Wagon Road, not far from Salisbury. Hezekiah Alexander, a Scots-Irishman, built another to the east of Charlotte, which he helped found in 1762. All families kept kitchen gardens not far from the door where vegetables, herbs, and flowers were grown inside a tall picket fence that kept the animals out. The kitchen gardener, usually the mother of the family, could draw from it all year long. Even in winter, the family could eat carrots and other root vegetables that were stored in the root cellar under the house. Building communities. All backcountry settlers brought their culture with them. Almost all valued religious expression, and most neighborhoods soon started to teach their values. The Scots-Irish built both a church and a school everywhere they settled. The first resident Presbyterian minister, Alexander Craighead, settled in Mecklenburg County in 1755. He established the first two schools in the backcountry. Craighead's assistant, David Caldwell, married Craighead's daughter Rachel, became a minister, and moved up to Orange County to teach and preach there. In 1767, the Caldwells built a house and school near the new Guilford County Courthouse. Germans often built union churches. People of their two principal denominations, the Lutherans and the Reformed, could worship together in those churches whenever a German-speaking minister came by. The English Quakers, who moved into the Uwharries, started meeting houses at Cane Creek in today's Chatham County and at New Garden in today's Greensboro. Deeper into the Uwharries, 16 Baptists from New England settled on Sandy Creek. Brothers-in-law Shubal Stearns and Daniel Marshall took the Baptists' religious message back and forth along the paths of the backcountry. By 1765, they had established more than a dozen new churches. Thousands of backcountry people became Baptists because of their work. The most active religious community in the backcountry was Wachovia. The Moravians lived in a more organized and structured environment than anyone else, and Wachovia became the most prosperous place in the backcountry. People journeyed as much as 100 miles to go there to buy needed goods, including stoneware pottery made of the area's bright red clay. The Moravians, in turn, bought up farm goods from their neighbors, combined them with their own produce, and shipped wagon loads of grain and other goods to Wilmington or Charlestown. The Moravians did so well that many neighbors resented their prosperity and religion. That jealousy was reported in the Moravian records in 1772, the year of a political controversy known as the Regulation. Strife and anger were evident everywhere in the backcountry after years of conflict between the new backcountry settlers and the more established areas on the coast. The regulation magnified some of the colony's old problems and created new ones, problems with which North Carolina struggled for a long time. Special feature, growing up, Moravian. Perhaps one of the first sounds a newborn baby heard in Wachovia was a song, for the Moravians were always musical, and they used song to worship and celebrate their lives together. Moravians were especially noted for their hymns and their horns, a distinctive sound found nowhere else in North Carolina. Moravians lived in communities that shared some property and many tasks. A person could only do a job approved by the whole community, and advancement through life was as much a group effort as an individual one. Although Moravians generally lived in families in their own houses, all believers belonged to different choirs at different stages of their lives. This way of life was part of the Moravian childhood. When children reached school age, they were separated into boys and girls choirs. Both boys and girls went to school in Wachovia. At some point, they graduated into single brothers and single sisters choirs in Salem, the central town. Each young person left his or her home and moved into new quarters with other unmarried people. As teenagers, each Moravian acquired some sort of skill. A young man might become a tanner or a brewer or a tinsmith. Most girls learned spinning and weaving. Choirs ate together and, during the week, held short worship services together. Sometimes these services were love feasts, where each worshiper drank coffee and ate a special potato bun. The act of eating together was their version of traditional communion. Life in choirs helped Moravians create a general economy. They shared their worldly burdens to ease the way to religious celebration. The whole community came together for religious holidays like Christmas Eve and Easter morning. Moravians also believed in the lot. They made major decisions for the whole community and for individuals by drawing one of two pieces of paper out of a box. They believed that the color of the paper, white for yes, black for no, directed them to take the right action. The members of the community required that anyone wanting to marry had to agree to what the lot said. Since the sexes were separated at an early age, most young men and women only saw one another at certain work and worship events, like snitzing bees, where apples were cut and dried in an oven. They seldom could talk to one another and were not allowed to be alone together. The lot, then, determined if someone should marry another person he or she barely knew. Sometimes a young man simply asked the male elders to select a bride for him. If a black piece of paper was drawn, however, that marriage could not happen. The young people had to wait for another person to come along. Young women could refuse the match even if the paper was white, but they had to live in the single sister's house until the next lot determined their marriage status. Most Moravian marriages seemed to have been as happy as any in other communities. It was considered the best part of one's life to have a home and family and continue the religious ways of sharing and obeying the needs of the community. When widowed, a man or woman joined a new choir, where their needs were taken care of until their death. Moravians were buried in God's acre, with identical stones over the graves, a symbol of the equality they practice with one another.